welcome to Medium Cool, a movie podcast. I'm your host, Austin Glidden, and as always, you can find us on social media by searching Medium Cool Pod on Instagram, and you can email us at mediumcoolpod@gmail.com. I am really happy to be back. I'm happy to talk today about our next title in the movie series, The Movie Review, where we look at movies that I have seen before, but I really need to watch again. Either this mostly consists of movies that I want, like, quote unquote, should like, or, you know, really popular movies that I don't feel like I have a really good opinion of anymore. I need an updated opinion. Another part of it is movies, quite frankly, that I didn't like, but I look back on them, I'm like, I have to like this movie, right? Like, it's exactly the type of thing I should love. And so, like Bergman movies, a lot of those I wasn't a huge fan of, and then I went back and rewatched them with Matthew Soucy a couple years ago, and some of them made me cry. They were blowing my mind, and I'm like, see, this is why I have to rewatch these things, because there is so much going on. So all that said, today we are going to talk about Clint Eastwood's Mystic River from 2003. This won a whole slew of awards and, you know, was one of the big titles at the time. This is also during, you know, Sean Penn's kind of, I don't want to say resurgence, but kind of being at the top, you know, of the Hollywood list, so to speak, at that time. And just a really great cast. It just has a lot going for it. And it used to be a 5-star banger for me. I mean, I loved this movie. I say it in past tense just because you'll get my updated opinion. Do I still feel the same? Who knows? Do I not like it as much? Who knows? Do I love it even more? I don't know. You'll have to find out. We'll get there in just a moment. I do want to highlight next week, real quick. Next week, I'm going to have Dr. Joshua Matthews on. He's a professor at a Midwest institution and the creator of the YouTube series Learning About Movies. So go check that out. Currently, he's doing some content on the 1980s. So he and I will talk a little bit about how he got into movies, and we'll dig into some of those 80s titles as well. So we'll step away from the movie review series for a week so I can bring a new guest on. Go check out, I'm serious, on YouTube, you should go check out Joshua Matthews Learning About Movies. And my favorite thing on his channel is, you know, why is this movie so great? He has these videos about like, why is this so great? And he'll just talk about these awesome movies and make you just want to go watch them or rewatch them. So I really enjoy his content, and he was kind enough to come on the show. So we will talk about that next week. For the time being, though, we are going to, let me just say this, excuse me, I am already running into scheduling issues with guests, okay? this is going to be a never-ending thing. This is what happens when you don't have a second host. You know what I'm saying? So Dr. Joshua Matthews will be on next week, and I feel confident that is all good and well. But, you know, I set up the entire schedule for the Medium Cool Movie Review Series, and now it's already falling apart, everybody. So I'm rescheduling that a little bit. Luckily, we have way more content prepared than I had anticipated. So tonight's episode is actually me pulling from a past recording of Joe and I. This has never aired, but when we did Seven, we also recorded Mystic River. And so I realized that we had talked way too long, because Joe and I can talk way too long pretty often. And I was like, you know, I'm going to split this into two episodes. So this is the next one. So if I talk about, when we talked about Seven, or if I mentioned that one several times, it's because we recorded those actually at the same time. But this is a part of the movie review series, as I said, and we're looking back at what many consider, you know, one of Clint Eastwood's great films. So let's go check in with Joe and see about Mystic River. Mystic River from 2003, directed by Clint Eastwood, written by Brian, I don't know how to say his name, Helgeland? Brian Helgeland and Dennis Lehane. Dennis Lehane is a name that I know just from things like Shutter Island. I think he did a movie called The Drop. I don't. He did. There was a point where he was kind of a guy. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it was really like people really knew the guy. The cast, Sean Penn, Tim Robbins, Kevin Bacon, Lawrence Fishburne, Marcia Gay Harden, and Laura Linney. The release date, I believe, was October 15th, 2003. The budget, $25 to $30 million. Box office, $156.6 million. So we're seeing another box office success, which Clint Eastwood is very, very well known for keeping his budgets low. Finishing movies on time, and the studios love this guy. It is streaming. I never mentioned Tubi as a streaming option, but I will say it is on there if anyone has that. But otherwise, you got to rent or buy this one if you want to go see it and don't already own it. So Mystic River is a psychological thriller that delves into the complexities of friendship, trauma, and the consequences of past actions. Set in a working class neighborhood in Boston, the film follows the intertwined lives of three childhood friends. That's Jimmy Markham, played by Sean Penn, Dave Boyle, played by Tim Robbins, and Sean Devine, played by Kevin Bacon, whose paths diverged after a traumatic event in their youth. When Jimmy's daughter is found murdered, which is not a spoiler, everybody. Don't worry. It's in the trailer. The three men are drawn back together, forcing them to confront buried secrets and long buried resentments. Now, this is where I start working to your part of this, Joe. Mystic River is a solid thriller that boasts decent performances from a cast, from its cast, with Sean Penn delivering standout moments throughout. The film effectively navigates its suspenseful narrative, drawing viewers into the gritty world of Boston's working class neighborhoods. However, while the performances are commendable, the film occasionally falls short in its portrayal of characters, opting for reductive storytelling to serve its overarching plot. Despite this, the movie manages to maintain a sense of tension and intrigue, keeping audiences engaged until the final moments. One surprising aspect of Mystic River is its subtle yet effective musical score, which I actually found out what Clint Eastwood composed. Like, what the fuck? That's so, I didn't know that till literally like 3 days ago or something. But anyways, which I think it enhances the film's atmosphere and heightens its emotional impact. Surprisingly, because the chord progressions and stuff used are not as dark as the film is. And so it really stands out in an effective way. While it may not receive as much attention as the other elements, the music plays a crucial role and the setting of the tone and enhancing key scenes. Now, I have provided a couple of criticisms, but also overall, I'm positive on it. But Joe, what say you, dear friend?
Yeah, I love this movie too. I'd probably disagree with you know, I'll listen to what you have to say about it, but I would probably have disagreements with some of the things, except for the very end of the film. Which I think it goes on about 5 minutes too long. Although I think that scene isn't ineffective. I think it doesn't end where it should end. And you know, I don't know. This is another movie like Seven, where the relationships are everything, and there's a very large intertwining of, you know, like you said, those paths that diverge from these three friends still are intertwining in a lot of ways, and it does a whole lot. It does a whole lot really well. I love it from the, you know, the beginning, the time that it shows, you know, if you don't know just kind of that beyond the setup is that, you know, these three, Jimmy, Dave, and Sean, are childhood friends, and they live in Boston in this, you know, this working class neighborhood, and they're out and they're playing street hockey, and they lose their ball in the drain, and they end up writing their names in concrete, and a car pulls up and a guy gets out holding a badge and starts, you know, yelling at them and is like, "What are you doing with my sidewalk?" And, you know, and they're, you know, of course these kids are, you know, and I made note of this. This is what kind of stood out upon rewatching this, is that I don't know that the scene would work the same today as it does, at least in that time frame that they're depicting in the 70s. You know, maybe even the 60s, I don't know. But it's during this time when before Stranger Danger was really a thing, right? And this was like, you listen to grown-ups in the neighborhood, you know, and you know, I remember, like, you know, my grandma and my dad, you know, saying, you know, well, if you know, if my kid was out messing around and, you know, and was like breaking windows or something, and some other mom caught him, like she'd just spank him on the spot. You know, it's like, you know, it was like that was the mentality of that time, particularly in working class neighborhoods like this. And so it's like when another adult is talking to you, you show them respect and you listen to them. And, you know, this guy takes advantage of that, kidnaps Dave and holds him hostage for, I believe they said, 4 days.
4 days,
And yeah, and the very strong implication was that there was a lot of sexual abuse going on, that he was being molested and raped and terrorized in so many ways. And we only see flashes of this, but then we see the aftermath of it, which is, you know, when Tim Robbins' Dave is an adult, he is stunted in a lot of ways. He's less confident than Jimmy and Sean both. He's you know, he is wounded in a or scarred emotionally, and you know, and as a result, like hasn't been gainfully employed the entire time. You know, they have this. There's a note. They at one point they say, you know, he's I can't remember the word they use, like, but it's like he's essentially like he's got a job most of the time. You know, he's sort of like off and on. He doesn't have a career. He's certainly not a successful detective like Sean is, and he's not a convenience store owner. You know, a local business person like Jimmy is. Although, you know, of course, Jimmy's got his own past and issues.
He's got a racket. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it, you know, there's they have these different paths that they all took, but they're still parallel. You know, in the town that they live in the neighborhood even that they live in. So there's boy, these relationships are complicated too. You know, when you're watching them together, Dave and Jimmy are still sort of like family when they're together. Sean is the one who is, you know, now is a big city cop, and he's, you know, but he still is like friends with them when they're together. It's like they just pick up where they left off.
Yeah. So, well, Jimmy and Dave married cousins.
Yes.
So they're tied together through family. Yep. Otherwise, but they're not close. Clearly, like you can tell, right. They're very clearly not close, but they're comfortable with each other.
Yes.
And then Sean is a cop. The opposite of Jimmy, pretty much. Yes. So, yes. You know, so it's like you have Dave, who is the outcast loner, who only has essentially a social life, it seems, because of the family he married into. Yes. Jimmy has his own racket, but is also like a member and a pillar of the community to an extent. Yep. And then Sean is a big city cop who goes back to the neighborhood and has to deal with his past, right?
Yes.
So, yeah, what you're saying, spot on, man.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so, yeah, it's, you know, it's just a nice solid base to start off with. Right.
Yeah.
for, you know, for a movie with a lot of, branches and a lot of relationships and that are all, you know, tied together again in the community.
Yeah. Yeah. I have several things to talk about that you've already touched on, like three of the four. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to start with friendship here. Obviously, Mystic River is interested in exploring the dynamics of friendship and loyalty and betrayal, obviously, and it's all within the context of what seems to be, at least to me, it feels clear, is a close-knit community in this area of the city. And the bonds between the characters are definitely tested as they navigate all of these complexities, like you were talking about, the complexities of trust. Like I said, betrayal, especially in the aftermath of this crime, Jimmy's daughter being found dead. Yeah. We don't know like what happened exactly. There's been word of a murderer. We don't know who that is. You know what I mean? Like there's a lot of unknowns there. But the film tends to delve into the fragility of like human relationships. And the links to which individuals will go to protect those they love, right? And even when faced with difficult moral choices. For some of the characters, the moral choices are harder to navigate than others, right?
Yep.
Some people are very quick to drop any moral compass they have. Just, you know, throw that right down the drain with that that street hockey ball.
Yep.
But yeah, I find the friendships interesting here. And it also kind of ties directly into, quite frankly, all of the rest of my points all kind of go together because, those friendships tie into trauma, they tie into guilt and they tie into, mental health in general. I mean, starting with mental health, like Dave is constantly looked at as a man possessed by his past.
Yes.
Like, there's not a person that knows of his past that doesn't bring it up saying, oh, that's why he's Dave. Like, that's why he's the way he is. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, he got in trouble. And then people that don't understand when they hear about it, they go, oh, makes sense. Like, yeah. no one questions it when they learn what happened, right? And yeah. and he carries it like a curse, too.
Yeah.
I mean, like, Dave, even if Dave could be better, mm-hmm. if the trauma could be worked through,
yeah.
he is so constantly reinforced with this curse
yeah.
of his past that he just owns it. You know what I mean? Like oh, yeah. that, like that's what he can't move past it because no one will let him move past it as well. Not to mention he comes from clearly a community of people that you know, if you're a man, like be a man, right? So
right.
clearly he is also kind of probably burying a lot of this stuff, yes. you know, like and try, because obviously it comes to a head at a certain point. But yeah, so like the mental health aspect of it and how that affects the friendships in this movie, that can be a complexity. The trauma, I mean, like that's a central theme, I think, in the movie. It's not even just Dave, though Dave is the most like glaring example of it. But it's, you know, the enduring impact of trauma and quite frankly, yeah. it's rippling effect through generations, right? It's,
yeah.
It,
yeah.
it's not just when they were kids. I mean, this has moved on through generations with them, and it's affecting other people around them and it affects how people love them. And the film portrays, you know, how traumatic childhood events involving this abduction, for example, with Dave Boyle, shapes the lives of not only him, but the three protagonists.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I mean, like Dave is someone who is protected by Jimmy because their wives happen to be family.
Yeah.
No mm-hmm. one's going to fuck with Dave. Are you joking? Because right. Jimmy yeah. will fuck you up. Like, right. like that's the thing. Right.
Yeah.
And even Sean is very careful around Dave because he knows what happened.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. he also doesn't want to start shit with Jimmy and he doesn't want to start, right. you know, like it, those things are complex. I 100% sure. Give that to you because I do have a couple of criticisms this time around.
Yeah,
but I agree with you so far. I mean, 100%. And it's interesting because I can see how the trauma haunts all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's not yes, just yes. Dave. Like
right.
this event haunts them all. There are points where I think Sean at one point is talking to Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
And says, like, you know, what if one of us had gotten in that car? Right.
Yeah.
Like uh-huh. they clearly are like tormented by this.
Oh, sure.
Like they've
yeah,
never
yeah.
worked through this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it just haunts them and it influences their choices and their relationships and their sense of identity. And it just underscores the film's complexities, like you were talking about human mm-hmm. psychology yeah, yeah. and friendship and the struggles through those past tragedies. Yeah. So, I don't want to talk about guilt yet, just in terms of friendship and the mental health and all that. Like, how do you see all of these things tying together and what connected with you? Because you clearly like really love this.
Yeah, I do. I do. And yeah, and it is that, you know, what you touched on was how, you know, that's the thing they said is sometimes I think we did all get into that car and you yeah, see, you yeah. know, with Jimmy, you know, Jimmy was a little rougher than the other two. And he grew up to be kind of a thug in his youth. He spent time in prison. And, you know, he's an ex-con. He's kind of sort of an ex-con made good because, you know, he's a business owner.
But real quick, an important thing to add to that is he went mm-hmm. to prison for 2 years for someone else.
Yes, yes.
I think that's a very specific thing for that character, actually.
Yes, yeah. He refused to roll over, or someone rolled over on him. Yeah. So this guy, just Ray is what he's called.
Yeah.
We don't
yeah.
see him. He's not a character in the movie that we ever see, but we see his children. And so he has disappeared. He's like gone. And he, rolled over on Jimmy. He cooperated with the cops and Jimmy got sent to prison. And, So about the time Jimmy gets out, he, you know, Ray is gone. And now he's got these two young kids, you know, who are being raised by a single mother, who, by the way, is a complete psychopath from the one scene we see him with her. She is a lunatic.
The great Laura Linney, by the way, yeah. Whom I love.
Well, no. I'm talking about Brendan and Who's the other kid?
Ray, the mutant kid. Yeah. My bad. Yeah. Well, first off, Laura Linney's also kind of a psychopath, but
No, but this woman, their mom.
Yeah. I know you're talking about now.
Yeah, there's a scene where the cops are talking to him. So the idea is that Brendan and Katie Markham, Jimmy's daughter, the one who has been murdered. So she's found murdered. They were planning on running away together. They were going to run away and get married. Jimmy doesn't approve of Brendan as a boyfriend. He's like, don't ever date one of the Harris boys because I'll disown you. That's a line that we get at some point. So of course you tell a headstrong young girl that, and she's like, and that guy instantly becomes more attractive, and they get together. They're in love and they're going to run away to Las Vegas. And then that morning there, she is found dead. And so the police, of course, naturally go to him once they find out their relationship, and his mom is there in the, you know, as they're questioning him. And there's, you know, and so she's like learning some of these things. She's learning about their relationship, learning that they're planning on running away together. And he, you know, and she like looks at him and she's like, "You were gonna leave me?" And he was like, "I was gonna tell your mom," like, you know. And so like she just changes like that and like turns on him even. And you know,
she doesn't give a fuck about what's going on.
Yeah.
She's just a part of the drama.
Right, yeah. And the cop and the cops, you know, Sean and his partner Whitey, played by Lawrence Fishburne, they're questioning him, and they look at one point, they're like, "Where were you last night?" And he's like, "Oh, I was in bed by 10. And they look at his mom, and they say, "Can you corroborate that?" And she goes, "I know that he went into his room and closed the door at 10. I don't know that he didn't open the door and climb out," you know? And it was just like, what a shitty thing for a mother to say, you know, your mom is supposed to protect you. She should be saying, "Yeah, by the way, I just went in there at 11 and checked on him and talked to him. And then at 2 o'clock in the morning, I went and checked on him and he was laying in bed asleep." But no, she was like, "Maybe he snuck out the window and went and murdered this girl. I don't even know."
God, you know? Yeah. go ahead, please.
Yeah. I was saying, so there you go with, you know, with like the loyalty of it that she felt betrayed and then just rolled right over on him. So there's, you know, there's that. So there's that family, and there's that family aspect of the sins, you know, the sins of the father is visited upon, you know, the other people. And in this case, you know, you kind of get a glimpse into what that family is like and why Jimmy hates them. And you don't know the full story at this point, but you know, but then you're looking and it's like, Brendan really seems like a stand-up kind of kid, like, you know, and people even say that to Jimmy. They're like, "Why do you hate him so much? Like, he seems like a good kid." And he's like, "You know, I don't hate him. I just didn't like his dad," you know? And it's like, you know, but that's the thing, is he's clearly still has this prejudice against him. So
Brendan Harris is played by Tom Geary, who I think actually does a great job.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
I think he's so good. There's that point where not only where they're questioning him and he's just constantly in a perpetual state of wiggly chin because he's like ready to cry. But he also looks kind of scary.
Yeah.
When he's like that. Uh-huh. And he's not supposed to, but it's like, but there's something. When people are genuinely emotional, sometimes they don't follow the grief script you have in your mind. And that's what that makes me think of. Like, mm-hmm. He looks flushed. Like the way that he gets when he's emotional like that feels more real because it almost doesn't feel real. And I don't know how to say that more, but I actually really love that. And I also want to say this, the Lawrence Fishburne and Kevin Bacon, so this would be Whitey and Sean respectively, their relationship is really pivotal to this as well. And this ties into a minor criticism I have, because I like this movie. I don't think this is executed that well, but I think on paper it works great. Okay. Yeah. And that's that Lawrence Fishburne is a cop. Okay. Mm-hmm. And he is a Boston cop. And Sean is too. But when he gets home, he's Sean. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so there are times where Sean is dealing with these past traumas and this loyalty, right? And this et cetera, et cetera. And he has personal involvement here. There's even a point where Whitey says, like, "I should get you pulled off the case. You're too close to this," basically. You know, like, and Sean's just like, "No, I can be objective," basically. Like, "I can do this." Mm-hmm. But Whitey emphasizes the complexity of the relationship Sean has with these other people.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So Whitey is the outsider. Sean is a whitey person now, right? Like he's not in that neighborhood anymore. He is a cop.
Right.
But because he returns to this, Whitey emphasizes how much of a neighborhood person Sean is. Does that make sense? Yes. So it's like, I feel like that's critical in terms of getting Sean to feel like he is a part of this community, or at least was, right? And I love that. And I think Lawrence Fishburne does fine here as well. Yeah. Like, I'm not blown away by him in this, though I do like Lawrence Fishburne a lot, but he does it well.
Yeah.
I think that guilt was one of the things that really got me, I think, the most, especially because it is treated so interestingly to me, and it's treated so differently throughout the film. Like every character treats guilt differently, kind of. So, when we talk about guilt or innocence or redemption, using that term again to tie that back into Seven, the characters kind of, they grapple with guilt in different ways, and it all stems from their actions or inactions, quite frankly.
Yeah.
As well as the burden that they have, like this responsibility for these past mistakes, maybe. Again, maybe not getting in the car or not stopping Dave from getting in the car as one example of many. A mistake could be Jimmy going to prison and leaving a single mother, right? I mean, like, there are a lot of things that they don't, some of these they don't even talk about, but you can deduce or infer from these things that you could understand how guilt could work into this. But I think that the characters do grapple with this, each of them in their own way. I think the film raises questions about going back to morality, justice, the blurred lines between right and wrong, quite frankly. We get a lot of similar Seven things here, which, everyone, just so you know, I chose Seven. I chose three other movies, and Joe was complicated and went, hey, how about this fourth movie? And then we did Mystic River. But what's funny is you picked a great companion piece, because the movies are different enough where it doesn't feel like you're watching the same movie. But I, now that I'm looking at my notes, I'm like, wait, we already talked about a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
But it's all in a different way, though. So, I mean, it is different, but we still get those themes. So, as these characters confront their pasts and confront the consequences of their actions, the theme of that redemption theme kind of emerges kind of as a driving force, I think. And I think there is often a hope for healing and reconciliation whenever the characters will allow themselves to find it. Of course, Jimmy struggles with that through a lot of the movie. But I don't know. When I think of guilt, Jimmy handles this differently. Jimmy is the kind that when he feels guilt, he gets aggressive.
Yes.
Dave is the kind where when he feels guilt, he gets introspective and tries to pivot.
Yeah.
From that discussion, right? Mm-hmm. And then Sean, as the cop, kind of takes his guilt head on, you know. So something we haven't talked about is Sean has a wife that a partner at least that ran off out of the blue.
Yes.
And she'll call him every once in a while, but not say a word. Mm-hmm. And he'll kind of talk to her, and then eventually she or he will hang up, and that's it. And there is a tremendous amount of guilt that he deals with. But you know what? Yeah. He never shies away from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's always there dealing with it. He doesn't get super emotional. He doesn't hang up. He doesn't freak out. No, he answers it and he just starts talking.
Yeah.
So the way that they each treat what I perceive, and maybe guilt might not be the right word, but what I perceive as guilt, I just love. I do love that part of the movie. I'll say that. Like, this really stuck out to me this time. What do you perceive of this? I guess
you're right on, and it jumps into the really the main thing I wanted to talk about with this movie was that it's communication and trust, and in this very we could say traditionally, you know, traditional value sort of neighborhood where everyone's working class and everyone's sure, you know, like you said, what a man is supposed to be, what a woman is supposed to be. And there's a lot of talk of that through the movie. It's like, you be a man and you handle your shit. And, you know, and, you know, this is a place where therapy is a dirty word probably for a lot of people. And, and I guess we should, you know, I should try to touch briefly on the plot. So, you know, so Katie is found dead. The night before, Dave came home late and he has blood on his hands and he's got a cut on his stomach, you know, on his midsection. And his wife, Celeste, that's Marcia Gay Harden, she is like, you know, he walks in and it's 3 and she's like, where have you been? And he's like, you know, and he has this story of a mugger who attacked him. And, you know, he's like, I think I killed him. Like, I just lost control. He cut me and I lost control. And I was like banging his head on the pavement. So she's like, this doesn't sound right. So she, the next morning, she's like, turns the news on and is like expecting to hear the news of a body found laying in, you know, in her neighborhood. And there's nothing, and there's nothing in the newspapers. And then the meanwhile, you know, here's a dead girl that they know. And, you know, and this is played, you know, she's Katie's played by Emmy Rossum, who is, by the way, is a fantastic actor. She was in Shameless. She was the lead in Shameless for several years on Showtime. Watch that if you never have. What a great show. And she's fantastic. But it's strange to me that her career is not, you know, that she's not a star on par with Angelina Jolie or, you know, people like that. Like, she's a tremendous actor. Yeah. And it's a shame that she, you know, she did Shameless and got, you know, I'm sure she got paid well for it, but she left that show and hasn't done a whole lot mainstream since.
Well, after Mystic River, I mean, she was doing other shit like The Phantom of the Opera and The Day After Tomorrow, but none of those movies really, really took off. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
No, yeah. But she was an absolute stalwart on Shameless for several years. And then she left, I think there was a season or two after she left. She left kind of after a public contract dispute. We're way off topic. But anyway, so there she is. This has devastated the community. It devastated Jimmy. And so, you know, the cops, Sean and Whitey, you know, again, Sean, their childhood friend, comes around, starts asking questions, starts saying things to Celeste, who is now slightly suspicious. She's like, something doesn't add up. And then the story changes. Dave's story changes. And it wasn't a mugger. It was a pedophile. And, you know, which obviously would be near and dear to his heart. You know, this is something that he would hate. So, you know, it's, again, is like understandable. But also they, you know, the people who he's telling this story to starts to think that maybe it's bullshit and that, you know, he did something else. Because again, he's messed up in the head. So there's these, you know, these people who are the closest to them, you know, Celeste, his wife, and then Jimmy, his childhood friend, they're doubting this story. And once things start to come to life, they're like, well, why did they keep that from me? And that increases the suspicion. Yep. And then, you know, and this just is the build through the whole film that, and Celeste is kind of, to me, the linchpin of that lack of communication that, she comes home and he's behaving oddly and she doesn't get at the heart of why. She just kind of sits and listens and is trying to guess things and deduce things. And she's like, why is he acting like this? And then people start to catch on to her, you know, how reticent she is to be around him and how suspicious she seems. And they're like, what's going on? And this is sort of the, you know, this is the catalyst for the, you know, the conflict later on when it all, of course, comes to a head. So this just kind of continues, is that they're all keeping things from each other. Sean, as the cop, is trying to get things from them, and they're all telling, they're like little white lies or omissions. Dave is certainly omitting information. Jimmy is, you know, trying to find out information with his buddies, the Savage Brothers, who, by the way, are complete cartoon characters.
Oh yeah.
And I hated them so much, but I also thought that they fit in this world and in this, you know, this neighborhood. Like, these are people who would come out of this neighborhood, just blind, dull, blunt instruments who, to borrow a phrase from, I think Casino Royale, Judy Dench's, James Bond is a blunt instrument. That's what these guys are. They're the kinds of people who get answers through talking really loudly and threatening and standing there in their leather jackets. And to me that all comes together. It's the toxicity of this neighborhood and the values that they taught, which they consider, you know, the way things should be, but are also the way that all of these terrible things are happening is because of this attitude, this, you know, men are this and women are this, and, you know, men should behave this way and shouldn't be emotional and should be, you know, they should never cry and they should be, you know, tough all the time and have this exterior. And if they don't, then they're, you know, they're thought of as being less than. So it's just all there, and it all festers until it finally blows up. And there's a whole lot of miscommunications that turn violent and turn, tragic. I'll even use that word tragic. So it's that's that whole amalgam that starts with not communicating or keeping things from each other. And you know, the judgment that's there, and the, you know, that's all under the surface. You know, there's a lot of those comments, like you mentioned with Dave, where it's, you know, and as a matter of fact, when he comes home, two of the parents are talking, and there's this real quick thing where it says, looks like damaged goods to me. And, you know, and it's like at that moment, you know, to your point, he had a reputation that he would never be able to really shake, that he's now off because of this experience, and he's been irreparably damaged, to the extent that, you know, maybe if they had gotten him some therapy, he could have been a little healthier.
Yeah.
And in a way, he's also the kind of the purest character in the movie. He's, you know, he's a doting father, and he has, you know, he has this kind of sense of right and wrong, that, you know, is maybe warped a little bit, but also is pretty strong and is pretty real. And you know, he gets along kind of, I guess, equally awkwardly with those toughs. And there's a scene toward the end where he's with the Savage Brothers and they're just hanging out, having beers. And it's like, you would think that someone like Dave, it would be tough for him to get along with people like that, but he just works, you know, with them. He's able to just hang out and have a beer and get drunk and laugh and have a good time.
But they're essentially family by this point too.
Right. I mean,
they are not by blood, but they're Jimmy's family.
Yeah.
His chosen family, we'll say.
Yeah.
And because like it makes sense. You're spot on. They don't fit, right? Uh-huh. Like the Savage Brothers and Dave don't fit.
Yeah.
But you also in context realize, like, well, he would probably be relatively comfortable with these people who are inherently uncomfortable. You know, because he's probably around them all the time because of every family gathering and every whatever. Mm-hmm. He clearly doesn't just hang around Jimmy. I don't mean to make that out.
Right.
Like that comes across pretty clearly. But their families are close enough.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's mostly the wives that are really entwined, but still. Mm-hmm.
It all feels very, to me, it feels like it could be a real neighborhood. It's very lived in, and it doesn't feel false. It doesn't ring false to me. And that's kind of one of the things I really like, is that these things seem relatively believable to me. This isn't like, you know, there's this conflict because the movie needs it. These all feel like very natural and real, relationships and conflicts and differences that grow out of a complex, you know, neighborhood of people who've lived there for generations.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I guess my the one thing I want to bring up, maybe less in favor of the movie that I never felt, and I want to be clear, this movie was like, when I first saw this back in the mid 2000s, probably, this was probably, like, this was a 5-star movie for me at the time.
Uh-huh.
Like, I fucking loved it. I was a big Sean Penn fan at that point. We have to also recognize that from around, 2001 with I Am Sam until about 2008, probably, with Milk, Sean Penn was a fucking leading man. Like, he was a draw, this guy. Now, not to say he didn't do movies before that. Of course, he did a ton.
Yeah.
But as far as, like, being a major, like, he's at all of the Academy Awards, nominated for something, you know, all that shit. This was his time to shine, it seems like, to me, if I had to kind of name an era. So this is smack dab in it. And he was a name, and you can feel that.
Yeah. And I think he won the Oscar for Best Actor for this film, too, if I'm not mistaken. I'm going to try to look that up.
Yeah, look that up, because actually I didn't look that up. So everything we're talking about, and I've already given it my praise in terms of some of these themes that I picked out that I loved. But I have to say, and I touched on this in my little intro, which was my take on it, on paper, I agree with everything you're saying.
Yeah.
As far as on paper, I'll say. And I think that just is a testament to how good the writing is. You know, I think it really is good. But honestly, like a lot of the performances and the execution of some of these things and the way that the scenes are kind of cut, blocked, and edited really made me feel like I was really looking deep into this movie to find things that I feel like should be more clear. So there are things like Dave, we've talked a lot about, I love the character of Dave on paper, but in the movie, to me, he is a one note performance. I don't think Tim Robbins is great in this. He's not bad by any means. I don't think anyone's bad in this. Okay. But I'm just saying, like, I feel like his character is one note. Now we can read into it like we're doing and we can rip apart the complexity of the character. I don't think that is executed well personally.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a testament to the writing and the context we get around it, but I don't think his character is realized very well. And I don't even blame Tim Robbins. That is an Eastwood choice in my mind, but
yeah. Let me say
please
this.
Please jump in.
Sorry, I'll come. So just back.
I won't forget. Go for it.
Sean Penn did indeed win Best Actor in a Leading Role, in 2004. Tim Robbins also won for Best Supporting Actor that same year. I will agree with you though that he's, I don't want to say weak link, but he's the least strong of those three leads.
Of those three, yeah.
Yeah, and that's. And yeah, he does it. He's a little more obviously doing an accent, and he's got mannerisms that are a little clumsier, maybe. Again, I agree. I don't think he's bad. I like him mostly, but he feels his acting is more noticeable and prevalent than the other two, who feel a little more comfortable.
Yeah. I mean, when I talk about like the reductive, I used that word earlier. Mm-hmm. I feel like that character, for as complex as it should be, is just reduced down to he is only what the story needs him to be, which strips him of the three dimensions to me.
Yeah.
To be honest, I actually feel that way about mostly about both Sean and Jimmy. Also, however, Sean Penn, for me, of the three, owns the screen. And it's for scenes like there's a scene where he and Tim Robbins are sitting on a kind of like a balcony. Or something. Yeah. It's like a weird second story porch. Like, and I know you'd say, yeah, balcony. No, this is like a little, it's little. I don't know. It looks weird to me.
Yeah, huh.
But anyways, they're sitting there and they're just drinking. And Jimmy, this is the day of his daughter's funeral, I believe. It's the funeral party after, however you want to say it, funeral thing. And, but Jimmy kind of gets away. He needs to get away from the crowd. So he's sitting out there. Dave comes out to smoke, sees him. Oh man, sorry. I didn't mean to bother you. No, sit down. They sit down, they start talking. And, one thing I did like about Dave was in this scene as well. Dave is awkward. Yes. He's like, should I go? Like, what do you want me to do? I love that. That actually was really great. Cause that's more of a subtle Dave moment. But man, the complexity of the emotions that Sean Penn goes through in that scene, Jimmy is the only character in the whole movie for me that doesn't feel simply reductive in terms of performance, but I think his character is reduced to being a thug.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so I miss, like, again, all of the things I'm pulling out with the trauma, the guilt, the friendship, I think that's all there and I can add to it whenever I read into it.
Yeah.
But I don't think Eastwood actually executes these things as well as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
And Sean, I think Kevin Bacon does a great job. I have nothing absolutely great or negative to say about him. I just think he nails it. I'll just say it that way. Like, not really award winning, you know, but I definitely disagree with the Academy on Tim Robbins and nothing against him. We've already said no one's bad in this.
Yeah.
But even what's her name? Hold on, I'll say it. I'll get it. Marcia Gay Harden. Golly. Yeah. Sorry. I was trying to think. But anyways, her character, we could read into this too on paper. Like, how fucking hard would it be right. to be married to a guy that you love. Mm-hmm. You love enough that you are willing to cover up a murder for them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Granted, she is married, or she is the cousin of a person married to a person that's probably had to cover up murders. Okay. So she's not maybe, you know, this would be a let's cover it up. If we need help, we'll get Jimmy, right? Like that kind of a thing.
Yes. Yeah.
And she's supportive and she hugs him and it's beautiful, right? Hmm. And then as she starts to struggle with this, again, on paper, it's just like, fuck, how hard would this be? You love this person this much. Mm-hmm. And now you're like, fuck, what if he killed my cousin's kid? Like, that's fucked. Right?
Right.
That's so crazy. I don't feel that in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. She's her character is frustrating. And I think that's by design. Because, you know, that's the kind of the conflict is that she comes off as spoiled and sniveling and, you know, like a loving wife, but also as soon as things go bad, she also doesn't have the same strength that they have in that neighborhood that
sure.
we don't snitch on our family.
She's the Tracy of this movie, but not as good.
Does not in a good way. Yeah. So yeah, but she doesn't have that value in her that everyone else has, that we don't snitch on our family. And she, like, very openly, like, as things go along, like, she's reticent at first and she's just like, oh, you know, I don't know, I'm just being crazy. Like, she has that lack of self-confidence, but then later on she just breaks and she goes and she's like, I think he did this. And like, to, you know, to Jimmy, who, like you said, is this like reformed thug. And he's, you know, he's trying to, you know, he's, I don't know that he's trying, but he has this past.
Well, there's a point where he says that he thought he was done killing people.
Like, yes.
It does seem like he sincerely is trying to go straight.
Yeah.
But I don't think emotionally he's ready to go straight. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not like, it's not exactly like a thematic struggle for him through the movie, right? Like, he's just at this point of his life where he's older and he's got a daughter who's about to go to college and, you know, and he's got two young girls and he's a family man, et cetera, et cetera. But he still has this is still in his blood. You know what I do want to say? I want to go back to, I did want to go back to something and I've like lost my train of thought.
Did you find it?
So back on, Tim Robbins, that scene on the little balcony thing.
Go for it. Yeah.
The one thing that I really loved about that was the, like you said, the awkwardness between them, but also that they also just fell back into their friendship. And this is, you see this in the dialogue where that scene where he's like, oh, you know, do you want me to leave? And Jimmy says, no, just sit here with me if that's cool. Like they sound like they're like, that's not the way he talks in the film. You know, he says, if that's cool, like,
yeah,
this is his childhood friend, right? That he's, you know, that he's falling back. It's like they fall back and they're both like suddenly 12 years old again.
Well, just to add to that, just to make your point even further, Dave is probably the only person he wants there. Dave has experienced extreme trauma.
Yes.
He's no stranger to intense emotions, right? He's not going to judge Jimmy, because if anyone's going to judge anyone, it's going to be anyone toward Dave. Okay. Yes. You know what I mean? Yes. Jimmy has nothing to hide from him. He can't be uncool to this guy. You know what I'm saying? Like he has nothing to worry about.
Yeah.
So of course he wants him there. And I agree. Yeah. It kind of sets that off. And there's even a point where it's the last moment of that scene where Dave just goes, I'm going to go. And Jimmy goes, yeah, all right, man.
And
it's just this. When I first heard him say that, I was like, oh, fuck. That it seemed a little harsh. But then it's like, no, they're just buddies. Like, he's just giving him space.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah,
continue, please. I wanted to make your point. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to just touch on that. But I do kind of agree with you that some of the points, or, you know, some of those things are maybe missed here and there. I do think that this script, well, number one, Clint Eastwood has a reputation for being efficient in direction.
Yes.
He doesn't do a lot of takes. He's the anti Kubrick in that way.
This is exactly what I thought of watching the movie, to be honest. Yeah. I was like, could have done a couple more takes.
Yeah. Cause it's just like, he lets the actors go and be actors. And that's a good style for him. It works. It's not, you know, like I said, it's not meticulous like Kubrick is, but it's, you know, and that's the extreme example. You know, he's known for a bazillion takes, you know, to the point of driving the actors insane. And Clint Eastwood's very much an actor's director who's like, yeah, go do this. And it's like, okay, do it again. Cool, we're done. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, but so, then you have someone like a Paul Thomas Anderson, from what I understand, where it's you let the actors be actors, but also you go, you know what? That was awesome. Uh-huh. You need to act a little bit more like this. And that's where I wanted this to be. Do you get what I'm saying? Yeah. Uh-huh. Like, yeah, like, because I do, I love that about Eastwood, where it's like, if I were an actor, I would love working with an actor director, because like, it's like you get acting, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's how I also imagine like, what is that guy's name? I just lost it. I just had it in my mind. It's I love the smell of napalm in the morning from Apocalypse Now.
Oh, it's Martin Sheen, or is Martin Sheen doesn't say that.
No, it's Rich.
Marlon Brando.
Nope.
Says that. Dude, Marlon Brando. Robert Duvall says that.
Thank you, Robert Duvall. Thank you.
I'll go through the whole cast.
Yeah, I was going to slap you. Robert Duvall, like when Robert Duvall, I think he, didn't he direct like The Apostle, or didn't he?
Yeah,
He directed one of those, but it's like I imagine him being that way too, because he is such an actor, like through and through. He has criticized Kubrick, even, you brought him up many times about, no, Kubrick is where you go to die as an actor. Like, you're not acting, you're doing... you're fulfilling a role, you know what I mean?
Right.
I imagine him being that way too. But honestly, I'm surprised how much what I'm talking about right now, with how everything feels like it just was reduced down to only what it needs to be in that moment. And that, I'm not talking about trimming the fat. Trimming the fat's good, right? Uh-huh. I'm talking about this brought it to skeletal level. like there's no meat and potatoes here for me. That it actually affected my experience overall, like, if you were to look at my rating, like, majorly, I still really like this movie. I recommend, like, check if you like these kind of crime thrillers like this or whatever. I mean, I love movies like this, so I'm going to like it, you know.
Yeah.
But I was just surprised at how kind of little heart I felt in it. Like, I was having way more fun watching this movie, analyzing it with these themes and stuff I pulled out, with the guilt and the friendship and the trauma, a lot of things you're saying. I picked these things out too. But I realized after I watched it that just the way that this is put together just made it feel flat for me, even though I know there's a lot to chew on here. And again, Sean Penn, I don't think consistently, but I think there are a lot of scenes where he really pulls it out, right? Like excels. And I love that opening scene, which you were talking about, you know, with them, the kids and the cement and the fake cops and the whole deal. I mean, there are moments really to love here, but I also agree with you too. The end left me a little flat as well. It doesn't feel like an end. And this doesn't ruin anything, listeners. So if you haven't seen Mystic River, I'm about to tell you a thing in the end, but it doesn't, you're not going to understand it, and it's not going to mean anything. Uh-huh. But there's a point where there's a parade.
Yeah.
And Jimmy is on a stoop with Savage Brothers and his family.
Mm-hmm.
And across the street, on the other side, is Sean, Kevin Bacon's character.
Mm-hmm.
And they make eye contact. Now, having gone through this whole procedure to find the killer and all this stuff, and they're kind of on the other end of this, and there's a bit of a resolution, and you just see them make eye contact, and slowly Kevin Bacon like does like a hand, like a gun with his hand, you know? Finger gun, and just goes, pew, you know, and just kind of does a little shot. And then, which I actually love Sean Penn's reaction, but Sean Penn just looks at him and kind of shrugs his shoulders like, it is what it is, that kind of a thing.
He kind of puts his hands up and is like, well, you know, that was a good moment. And that's the thing, is that last sequence is a good sequence, but
it's not an ending.
Tacked on to the end of the movie, it just feels like, it feels like Return of the King, Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, where, you know, when it ends 30 times, it kind of feels like that. And there's this weird, like, Lady Macbeth scene with Laura Linney, and, you know, where she's just kind of over explains something to Jimmy. And it's just, it just doesn't quite hit. I wish they had cut that part out, her little speech. If her speech had gone away, had not been there, and it just ended with that parade. There's another character there that, you know, that would be a spoiler to say much more, but there's a character who's also like kind of running around aimlessly, and another character who's very sad. And it's just sort of a, it's again, it's a kind of a tragic ending compared to, you know, comparing it to Seven. Those endings are also similar in that way that they're both, there's a tragedy to it that, you know, that that comes about and where, you know, kind of the bad guys win in a sense.
Yeah, I'm not going to prolong this because I'm going to speak vaguely and it's going to piss off any listeners who haven't seen this.
Yeah.
But I just want to speak, if you know, you know, kind of a thing. If you've seen it, you know. But yeah. there is a scene where where Jimmy and Sean are talking, right?
Yeah.
We will say Sean comes over to Jimmy and tells him what the cops have learned. And he and Jimmy have a conversation. Jimmy exhausted at this point. He's been up all night. And they're standing in the street. And there's a ton of fucking subtext going on in this scene because of the context of what's happened. But they just have a conversation and then they start walking down the street, I believe, or the camera pulls away or something and they're in the street. However, and then it fades out. Why didn't the fucking credits start there?
Right. Why do we then
cut to the Laura Linney thing and then the fucking parade? Is it because it's in the book or something? Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. It was just such a, it was just such like a perfect ending moment. And they were just like, well, wait, we got to say one more thing. And it's just like,
I love shit that doesn't explain itself.
Yeah.
Like give me that shit all day. Like, but this isn't in a way I appreciate. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the kind of the hard part about it is that I like the second half of that next scene, but I also have to fully admit and like gladly admit that it should not exist in the film. Yeah. It should just be gone because the previous moment was just such a perfect ending and it was, and it just encapsulated the entire film. That last scene doesn't add anything. It's just like a coda. Like you said, it's just like the postscript of a novel. And it just exists, I guess, because that's where it ended in the book. And it brings the film down just a tick. As a matter of fact, I gave this 4.5 and I was like, I was sitting there watching. I was like, God damn, I love this movie so much. And while I'm watching it, and then I got back to that scene and I was like, yeah, this just pulls it down. It just, you know, it just pulls it down. And it, the movie was moving at such a, like we said, an efficient kind of clip, even though it's a little on the longish side, I think. I want to say it's like over two hours and 15 minutes or something like that. Just long ish.
And yeah, 2 hours and 18.
But then this adds another, I don't know, 3 to 5 when it's just, it should have been done. And that last image is such a good metaphor and, you know, for what happened. And it was the spot. And it's very obvious. You're just like, you expect the camera to pull back. And then all of a sudden it's like, cut, another scene. And I'm like, oh, damn it.
I'm pretty sure if I remember correctly, and do not trust me on my memory. Mm-hmm. But I'm pretty sure that it fades out and then it comes into this little epilogue or whatever. And the thing is, think of all of these. I'm in the wrong thing here. So think of all of these themes, the trauma, the guilt, the friendship, the mental health. When you watch that scene in the street with Jimmy and Sean, every one of those themes is weighing on the context of that moment. And if these are the things that the movie's about, how couldn't you fucking end there?
Right. Right. Exactly.
To me, it ends almost like if it ended there, it wouldn't be that much unlike something like Prisoners, the Villeneuve film, where at the very end, Gyllenhaal is standing on this property trying to find Hugh Jackman's character. And all of a sudden he never hears it. But the audience, you hear a whistle. Right. And you can deduce what's going to happen from there, you know, but it's like, but I like that it kind of leaves it a little open. Right. I love that about this. Like once you figure out what the themes are and how this plays in and their relationship, you know, like Sean knows Jimmy's not going to get caught for anything he's done.
Right.
And Sean knows he can't do shit about the context of that scene. Right. Yes. So they just stand there.
Right.
That's fucking great, bro.
Yeah.
Like, and the end isn't going to ruin like the whole movie for me. And like I said, there are even things in the end I like. I said, the reaction Sean Penn has to Kevin Bacon's finger gun thing. Right. Mm-hmm. But it's like when I write music, Sometimes I write the best riff of the whole song, but I just can't figure out where it fits. And sometimes I have to just shelve the riff for another song because it doesn't work here. And even though there are great moments in the end of this, it just should have been shelved. That's my opinion.
Yep.
But any final thoughts before we close this out?
Yeah, no. I love this movie. Like I said, it was a Best Picture winner. There's a couple little things that you mentioned. I think I probably think they're smaller than you do. I think you gave it 3.5, didn't you?
I was teetering on the 3.5 and the 4, but as I get older, I tend to go toward the lower, and then if I watch it again, I'll raise it. So it is in that 3.5 to 4. I have to say 4.5 is a little high for me, but I do want to say one thing, and then I want you to pick up because I just interrupted you. But I'll just say that it's less than I think these are. Well, when you say that this was a bigger deal for me maybe than you, I want to say that. And I know you mean this, but I want to clarify this for my own sanity. It's that it affected my experience, and it didn't affect yours as much. And I just want to reword it because I don't want to sound like a petty bitch. Okay.
Listen, we all know by now, don't we?
I know. But since I am a petty bitch, I don't want this to be perceived as one of the petty bitch things. Okay. I have other things to be a petty bitch about. These things I'm talking about really affected me to that extent, to the point of I did give it a 3.5. Even as we were talking about, I was like, should I switch it to 4? It is on the cusp. It probably does deserve a 4, but we'll decide whenever I watch it again. But please continue. Right. Please give me your last thoughts.
I love the complexity of it. And again, this is one I've seen multiple times too. Over the years, I've watched it. I've gone back to it a lot just because I like that, the all the relationships and how they all fit together in the context of this little cusp of, or this little cross section of humanity. And it's frustrating, because of their values. It's frustrating at times, but in a good way, in a kind of an insightful way mostly. But it's again, a movie that has a somewhat of a, cynical worldview. You go back to that opening scene where we meet Sean, where they're arresting a man who's shot someone on the highway because he kept cutting me off, and the guy just like is yelling like, he kept cutting me off. And Whitey says something like, this guy's gonna confess to the JFK assassination in a minute. He's just giving himself all up. But it's this like the ridiculousness of this situation where he feels justified in shooting somebody because he cut him off on the highway. And it's just this whole thing of like how horrible, and I used the word toxic earlier, toxic the world is. Certainly this neighborhood is a bad place that people, you would think have fond memories of, the people who live there have fond memories of it. Like, oh, my childhood was great. And it's like, no, your childhood actually sucked. Like it was terrible. Like you got your ass beaten at home and you got your ass beaten on the way to school, and it affected you in bad ways and has left you a shell of yourself, not a healthy, well-adjusted human being. And that's kind of the one thing to take out of this, is that none of these characters are healthy and well-adjusted. Ironically, Dave maybe to some extent was, but also was the most wounded as well. So,
because of his trauma, he was the one that probably had the best chance of being, but decided to stay in that space. And and to also touch on the Sean thing on that bridge where the guy shoots the guy and Whitey and Sean are standing there talking about it. Yeah. That is an exemplar of the neighborhood. Sean is brought back into this space. We see this literally visually. Where on the bridge he's addressing this, and then it cuts to an over the shoulder where he can see the neighborhood. And he says, "Oh, there's the neighborhood." There is a deliberate tie to you are an outsider now.
Yep.
With nostalgia for this, exactly what you were describing.
Yeah.
And then added to that, well, can I go there? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Can I fit in anymore because I'm from here? But I know these guys, I know people here, but this is crazy. Someone shot someone out of, you know, like,
right, yeah,
yeah. So it's pretty wild. Yeah. So yeah. Any final things?
Yeah. No, that's my closing thoughts on it. I think this is a tremendous film. I'm tempted to call it Clint Eastwood's best film. I mean, Unforgiven might have something to say about that. There's a couple others that would probably have that would argue that as well. But I think it's up there. It's probably top three for him, for me.
I would agree with top three for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, dude, I refuse to do it right now, but I am in my memory already, only having watched this like 3 or 4 days ago. Mm-hmm. I'm already tempted to change it from a 3.5 to a 4, but it's mostly because of everything we pulled from it. 3.5 was an honest representation of my experience, but sure. Like, just thinking of it, it's a movie I almost love talking about more than I actually like watching. But Unforgiven, in my opinion, that's a 5-star movie for me. Like, that is fucking easily his best movie.
Yeah. Okay,
For me. But I agree with you. Mystic River is definitely up there. I still, despite giving it that, like, that's still very positive for me. And I encourage people to check it out. I think Mystic River is very good, as do I, 7, which, yeah. So, all right, cool. Well, Joe, as always, buddy, thank you so much for talking about this. I think we plan to be back next time with Sam. So we'll have you back soon.
Let's do it. I'm gonna have a good time. I know he loves The Abyss, and I love to give him grief about The Abyss. And whenever, you know, he and I like to mock antagonize each other. And one of the ways I'll do it is I'll just be like, Sam, The Abyss is an average film. And that just pisses him off to no end. Dude. So expect that from me next time.
Yeah. I will say this. And when once I rewatch that, I've seen that one technically recently enough to remember, but I am going to rewatch it before next week.
Yeah.
And I want to say that might be, and this is might be a controversial statement for some, but that might be my favorite Cameron movie now.
Wow. Okay.
I'm not sure. I love that movie, dude. I'm just saying.
Love each other.
I know. So we'll see how I feel like rewatching it again and see. But with that said, buddy, let's get out of here.
All right.
All right. That was our discussion, Joe and I, talking about Clint Eastwood's Mystic River from 2003. As I said at the top of the show, we're going to have Dr. Joshua, I'll say it right next time, Joshua Matthews. As I said, he's a professor and a creator of the YouTube series Learning About Movies. Go check that out. I'll probably be pitching that next week as well. On top of that, coming out this Friday, I was happy to see that they are re-releasing Alien. So this is a something-something-if anniversary. Let me do some math real quick. 45 years ago, Alien was released. This is Ridley Scott's 1979 classic. I think the best of the Alien films. But apparently that's being re-released. I'm sure that's re-released in select theaters. So keep an eye to see if that's out. Some of the new movies coming out. Challengers, Boy Kills World, which I already know Joe's wrong about, but I have to see the movie to see if I agree with him or not, so I'm just saying that out of spite. And then Caitlin Cronenberg created Humaine. Caitlin Cronenberg is obviously the offspring of David Cronenberg, and she made her directorial debut here with Humaine. So those are three of the more notable films coming out. I'm looking forward to seeing them all. If you get to see them and have some pretty strong opinions either way, hit us up, Medium Cool Pod on Instagram, and you can email us at mediumcoolpod@gmail.com. Now, until next week, good night, good luck, and take it easy.